Hopefully allow enough time for questions and be sure that Roland gets up on schedule. I got interested in this topic in teaching astronomy, especially over the last couple of years, importance of the moon for life on Earth. I happen to be at Wheaton College, or at least have been, associate of the Wheaton College. I taught my last, perhaps 3 weeks ago, finishing up a summer session. 50-year career at Wheaton, although we've been overseas several times. In fact, the most recent being maybe 2 weeks ago, we were in China hoping to observe the eclipse. You can see how far my interest in the moon extends. And we were in Shanghai, a location that was supposed to be reasonably hopeful, although we were well aware that you have about a 40% chance. And in fact, we did watch the partial eclipse through shifting clouds, but as totality approached and the temperature began to fall, it clouded over, and then it got very dark. I don't think I've been in quite as dark an eclipse. It was just like night with the cloud cover as well. And then about 10 minutes later, it started to rain, so we had to run quickly back to the bus and on with our tour. I was teaching in China last October, but this was an opportunity to do some touring in China as well. Well, let me move on with this topic, importance of the moon for life on Earth. Let me mention a few unusual features of the moon to begin with. Our moon is the largest moon relative to its planet by a factor of about 50. Now, to qualify that a little bit, that takes into account the fact that Pluto is no longer considered a planet, now considered a dwarf planet, one of the Kuiper belt objects. The moon is also has the largest angular momentum relative to the mass of the planet that it orbits, and from moon missions, the Apollo missions, it was found that not only does the moon have a low density, but lacks iron and many of the volatiles that differentiate it from just a captured asteroid. So these are rather unusual features. This particular picture of the moon, by the way, let me go back, is taken from the Messenger spacecraft on its way to Mercury. I think it's now orbiting Mercury. I should have double-checked that, but I think this just was sent back within the last year. I'm particularly interested in the Messenger spacecraft because it's the first spacecraft to use a phased array antenna, and that happened to be the area of my research 50-some years ago. The origin of the moon, just to quickly outline some background information, several theories have been proposed, going back to Laplace in conjunction with his nebular hypothesis, the co-accretion or co-creation theory. You might think of it as a sister theory. The moon formed together with the Earth and in orbit around the Earth. This has a number of problems, though. It does not account for the high angular momentum of the Earth-Moon system compared to the other planets. If the Earth and the Moon formed together out of the original nebular cloud, why would it have this unusually high angular momentum? Another theory, the fission theory, proposed by George Darwin, the son of Charles Darwin, who did a lot of work on tidal theory and so on. This might be called a daughter theory, a theory in which the moon splits off from the Earth. But it turns out, further analysis has shown that even though the Earth has high angular momentum, it does not have enough angular momentum to account for this kind of a fission process. A third theory, the capture theory, developed by Urey in 1952, there may have been earlier versions, attempts to further develop it in 1968 by Fisher. If I carry on this feminist analogy, this might be the wife theory, but at any rate, the problem here is that if you have an object coming in and is captured by the Earth, it would go into a highly elliptical orbit unless there's some braking mechanism to slow it down and to bring it into a circular orbit. So all of these have not been able to successfully account for the origin of the moon. A theory has developed, though, just within the last 25 years, that 30 years, that has been very fruitful. It was first proposed in 1976 by Hartman and Davis, this idea of a large impact object, perhaps the size of Mars or even greater, in a grazing collision. By 1980s, computer simulations had shown that this was a feasible model. This is one such series of simulation photos where the collision takes place here, and in that glancing collision, a lot of heat is generated, and the colliding object then is vaporized, and much of that debris then is blasted out into space, where it eventually coalesces to form the moon. We'll look at a little more detail presently. But this model and the computer simulations associated with it, even though for about 8 or 10 years this theory was not taken too seriously, but a conference of the American or International Astronomical Union, I think it was, at Kona, Hawaii in 1984, this seemed to begin to gel, and a consensus emerged that is now very strong in favor of this theory. The large impact theory, grazing collision, simulation typically requires a Mars-sized object, perhaps a tenth to maybe even as much as 0.14 the mass of the Earth, a speed of about 5 kilometers per second. One of the early simulations that is that of Benz and Cameron at the Smithsonian, refined a little more recently by Robin Canup at the Southwest Research Institute. But here you even have a time scale associated. One important thing that seems to occur in all of the simulations is that when the collision occurs, the object is large enough to have its own iron core, and that iron core, as well, both the Earth and the impacting object are largely, we'll look at the temperatures in a moment, but are largely in a molten state after the collision. The vaporized material then blasts into space, and the iron core eventually falls back and adds to the core of the Earth. So a significant contribution to the mass of the Earth. At the same time, much of the crust of the Earth is stripped off, which is rather significant. And that also occurs in most of these models. And you end up then with a proto-moon. At roughly outside of the Roche limit, perhaps, four or five Earth diameters, six Earth diameters is sometimes taken, in, which matches about a six-hour day in the early, a six-day rotational revolution period for the moon. So the moon, let me go back, a six-day rotation of the Earth. One of the results that we'll see is that this has a very strong relationship to the rotational period of the Earth. And in the early collision, when the moon began to form, the Earth was thought to be rotating at about a six-hour day. Of course, that eventually we'll see is slowed down due to tidal action that occurs following the collision. Well, let me look at a couple of these simulations that you can find on the internet, mostly done at the Southwest Research Institute in Colorado. This is a typical one that, where you see the various phases. Let me just concentrate on this one where the yellow is approximately the temperature of the sun, around 5,000 Kelvin. The red is about 7,000 Kelvin. So you've got clearly a situation where the Earth is again in a molten state. The collision is believed to have occurred probably within less than a half a billion years after the formation of the Earth, maybe 4.3 billion years ago. But at any rate, the red is around 7,000 Kelvin, the yellow about 5,000 Kelvin, and the green perhaps 3,000 Kelvin. Let's see, I think I have another simulation here that is, if I can find the cursor and get it there to on the, yeah. Okay, there the collision, and immediately a molten state, the fallback of the core. It looks like there might have been a second fallback there, and then the moon itself comes out of nowhere, but obviously the an elliptical orbit at the beginning. Maybe I can run that once again. This is one of many different simulations. Now, I don't know exactly what that second fallback was, but there, in the meantime, the moon has been forming. So now let me go back and pick up one point I think I missed here. Robin Canup at Southwest Research Institute has refined the simulations. Some of the early simulations required more than one collision. She's been able to show a single collision with only with a mass of only about one tenth of the Earth mass of the Earth, still a little larger, I think, than Mars, and it has these various features that I've referred to: the fallback of the core of the impactor, and so on. Stanley Yockey has picked this up in a little booklet that. Is available, I think, from, I think I have it here, it's available, I think, from the Jesuit organization that he's associated with. If any of you are interested in that, you can check with me later. But he points out how rare such an event would be, which is confirmed by the Spitzer Infrared Telescope. He points out that it would have to have the right size, it would have to occur at about the right time to have the right effect on the Earth, be in the right location in the solar system, be in the right direction or the right plane, have the right speed. He doesn't take into account spin, but perhaps that would also have to be taken into account. And then he tries to estimate the kind of probabilities that might be associated with that, 0.1% for the right size, 10% for the right time, in the early formation of the solar system when there are planetesimals around, and but for it to be there at just the right time and the right location, he has various reasons for suggesting something like a 20% probability in the right direction and the right speed. But he ends up with something like just for having the right conditions to produce the moon and to affect the Earth in a way that we're going to outline presently, that you have on your handout, that allows for life on Earth, a probability of about one part in 10 million. So that added on to the probabilities of the Earth having just the right conditions, which are very small, you have this additional factor that Yockey and others say we need to take into account. The Spitzer telescope has recently returned evidence I think, a survey of about 500 stars in the process of formation, and they look for dust signatures that would imply a collision of some kind between objects in the formation of a given planet. And they've set an upper limit of about 5% of planets that might have a collision that could give rise to this kind of a process that leads to the formation of a large moon and just the right conditions for the planet. Now, let me move into 10 results of a glancing collision that I've tried to identify. And somewhat speculative, I would have to concede, but further research shows that, in fact, all 10 of these are necessary conditions. Every one of them, I think, is almost essential for life to occur. A little book by Neil Cummins, I think in the 1990s, What If the Moon Didn't Exist, that actually is the first chapter in a book that speculates about other possibilities in the solar system. But he identifies about 3 or 4 of these results of a glancing collision that are necessary for life. Rare Earth, Brownlee and Ward's book in astrobiology, I think 2000 publication date, identifies 4 or 5 of these. And then in Gonzalez and Richards, 2003, I think it was, Privileged Planet, he identifies, depending on how you count there are different variations on these, but 5 or 6. And then as I was finishing up, I see that Hugh Ross has come up out with a new book. He seems to always be right at the forefront of bringing all of these ideas together. A book called, I wrote it down so I'd be, yeah, More Than a Theory, 2009. And also a video A Journey Toward Creation, where he shows some of these simulations and provides more detail. In looking at More Than a Theory, the book that he's most recently published, he seems to have about 7 or 8 of the 10 that I've identified. Maybe later I could point out the 2 or 3 that he does not include, which I have included. But let me move through these quickly then, since my time is going. First of all, such a collision is believed to have removed the greenhouse gases that are quite evident in the case of Venus. Venus is completely surrounded by a cloud cover, an atmospheric pressure about 90 times that of the Earth. It produces such an intense greenhouse effect that the surface of Mercury the surface of Venus is about 700 or 800 degrees, enough to melt lead, and certainly much more than would ever allow for life. So not only are the greenhouse gases removed, but just the right combination of chemicals remain in the atmosphere, and the atmosphere is thinned enough so that photosynthesis is possible to eventually produce oxygen. So I'm proposing, and others have suggested, that a glancing collision is what differentiates our planet then from that of Venus and gives us an atmosphere that allows for life. A glancing collision increases the rotation rate, something like a 6-hour rotation, and also perhaps the optimal axial tilt for ideal temperature range. I don't know if any work has been done to actually show that the 23.5 degree tilt is the precise optimum, but certainly it's close to the optimal axial tilt. Mercury, which has no tilt, or very practically no tilt, and a very long rotation, 59-day, means that it has very long hot days, up to 700 Kelvin, very long cold nights, 100 K, Calvin, again, conditions that would not allow for life, where we usually think at least life as we know it, requiring water, setting the bounds between 0 and 100 degrees Celsius, or 273 and 373 K. So a collision then of this kind would have, I don't know if you can see that, but set the Earth into more rapid rotation. Venus, I think, has a rotation about 225 days, Mercury 59 days. So typically, the planets apparently did not have a lot of rotational momentum, but an event like this would account for the rotation that the Earth does have, and 24 hours eventually, as the Earth slows down, but initially something like 6 hours, leads to conditions that are perhaps necessary for life. Third item, strong magnetic field from both the faster rotation and the larger molten iron core. From the dynamo model for the formation of the Earth's magnetism, both of these factors are needed, a more rapid rotation and a larger iron core. And so this model would suggest that both are provided by this kind of a glancing collision. And this magnetic field, of course, is essential to deflect the solar wind that would otherwise strip the atmosphere and threaten life. I had when I was presenting this recently in astronomy class, an alert student said, how can you say that that a strong magnetic field protects the Earth, and yet we know that Venus does not have a strong magnetic field, and yet it has a very thick atmosphere. Why didn't its atmosphere get stripped since it doesn't have this kind of protection, the deflection of a magnetic field? And so I had to look into that a little more carefully and discovered that just last year, the European Space Agency sent up two space probes, the Mars Express and the Venus Express, specifically to measure the effect of the solar wind in stripping the atmosphere. And they found out that that is occurring at rates more than they anticipated, and not just incrementally. It occurs almost in terms of large chunks of atmosphere sometimes being removed, especially the lighter elements like hydrogen, and that means water vapor being stripped more easily than some of the other greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide, which are heavier. And they've been able to document water molecules being, water being removed from Venus. I think there's on the internet, a graphic they show, which I don't think is a photo. I think is a graphic to suggest the stripping of the atmosphere, although it may be a photo. But apparently Venus has enough, for one thing, Venus has a thicker crust, which traps the heat of the planet, and then you get every periodically on something like a 100 million year basis, several 100 million year basis, widespread volcanic activity and gas, the outgassing then occurs on a fairly continuous basis on Venus to replace its atmosphere, even though it's being stripped. Of course, in the case of Mars, the atmosphere has been nearly completely stripped, only about, what, something like 1% of that of the Earth. So our atmosphere does seem to have been preserved by a magnetic field. Stronger gravity from the more massive core. The Earth holds water vapor longer before condensing to form the oceans. This is a point that Hugh Ross made in some of his earlier books, but this provides a mechanism for that stronger gravity as compared with Mars, which has lost most of its water. Then one, many of the models show a fallback of as some of these vaporized minerals condense. They fall back after the crust is already beginning to form. Most of the heavy elements fall differentiated is the word that is used. They fall to the core. But there is this, what's referred to in the literature as a late veneer of minerals that fall back and provide heavier elements then that are needed for life. If you just have a molten planet, the heavy elements tend to fall to the core, but this provides a mechanism for heavy elements in the crust and the mantle that can then, through processes of tectonic activity and so on, be brought to the surface. Well, plate tectonics, sixth factor that is unique to the Earth among known planets, none of the other planets in the solar system, and it seems to be partly the case that we have plate tectonics, whereas Venus and Mars and the other terrestrial planets do not, because of the thinner crust, and that perhaps is another factor in the glancing collision. The crustal material of the Earth would have been much of it blasted into space and a thinner crust then, and more heat in the mantle, both from radioactive elements that would have fallen back as well as the heating up of the collision itself, but provides then the mechanism for driving the tectonic plates, which this is, by the way, from rare earth, this carbon cycle that controls our climate even as the sun's radiation increases. I won't go into the detail, but volcanic activity, which produces carbon dioxide and increases the temperature, but then as it weathers and is washed into the oceans, then you begin to get a rise in a decrease in temperature, but then that is recycled through tectonic activity and carbon dioxide again added to the atmosphere. So this is a kind of a negative feedback mechanism that keeps our temperature fairly consistent over long periods of time and essential for life. And of course it produces the continents. If the Earth was simply without plate tectonics and relatively smooth surface, we would essentially live on a water planet, but tectonic activity then produces the continents and the oceans, which again seem to be necessary for life as we know it. Number seven, the oceans are enriched with minerals by huge tides from the early moon. The early moon being, say, 10 times closer than it is now, the tidal forces, which go as the cube of the distance, would be perhaps 1,000 times greater. So you can imagine tides that might be at least 100 times higher than we experience on Earth today, washing far inland and eroding materials, minerals that have fallen back and are in the crust of the Earth, eroding into the oceans much more effectively than is the case presently with our the smaller tides that we have. These huge tides, as well as a faster rotation of the Earth, meant that the tides occurred more often. And then after a period of time, the oceans having formed and so on, you begin to get the typical tidal action that slows the rotation of the Earth. I won't go into the details on that, but the essential for slowing the Earth's rotation, if it did have that early rapid rotation, which would have been associated with super hurricanes. If the Earth was rotating once every 6 hours, you'd have hurricanes that are much more powerful than the hurricanes that we actually experience on Earth. Life probably wouldn't have been able to gain a foothold with that kind of hurricane activity. And the slowing then of by tidal action eventually optimizing the climate at the period that we're associated with, the 24-hour rotation. And finally, these last couple of items are items that are known, of course, much earlier. The tides driving the ocean currents moderate the global climate, cleanse and oxygenate the oceans, all of this due to the moon's action, gravitational action, and some believe that tidal pools in the early formation of the earth allowed the concentration of nutrients for early life forms to develop. Problems associated with those ideas, but Darwin's idea of these tidal pools perhaps is the origin of life. There is an interesting correlation between the sun and the moon. It turns out that if the sun and the moon are at their current distances, the moon is just the right angular size to cover the sun, and therefore we have solar eclipses that are possible. But that condition, you can show, also leads to approximately equal gravitational forces from the sun and the moon, and that gives you the longer cycle, sometimes called a beat frequency, of the spring tides and the neap tides. So you have spring tides, and then the neap tides, and then a couple of weeks later, spring tides. And under those conditions, you have a couple of weeks for the tidal pools to evaporate and concentrate nutrients. I notice in a footnote in Privileged Planet, Gonzalez and his co-author are cautious. They don't. They do mention this in a footnote, but they say that under the conditions where life might have formed, the moon would have been closer, and the moon would have dominated the gravitational forces. However, I think there's evidence to show that the moon's recession has not been in a linear fashion. I think it's something like the empirical data from coral reefs shows that the Earth had about a 20-hour rotation within the last five or 600 million years ago. So you still would have had some comparability between the gravitational forces of the sun and the moon, and the variation of high tides and spring tides and neap tides. Well, finally, since about 1990, we've known that the tilt of the Earth's axis is stabilized by the moon. We know that Mars, which does not have a large moon, recent evidence from the Mars orbiters has provided data to show that Mars has a chaotic variation in its tilt, so you would not have regular seasons. And we would not have the kind of seasonal variation that holds over long periods of time. At about 23 degrees, the variation between summer and winter, and so on. And so finally, I would suggest in conclusion, the giant impact theory of the moon's origin accounts best for its properties. It appears to have had just the right conditions and effects to make life on Earth possible. Yeah, I'll maybe take about 2 minutes for questions, but I've already run about 3 minutes into Rollins' time. Yes?
In terms of contacting you in the future, is your Wheaton email address going to stay active?
It will, yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah?
The switching of the magnetic field of the Earth, is it moved by a precedent?
I don't know. That's still, I think, somewhat of a mystery. I know the dynamics of the dynamo model is a very complex model, but I wouldn't be surprised that it does. And that switching has been suggested, I think, by some that it might lead to more rapid mutations at certain points. But, yeah, that would be an interesting thing to pursue. In some ways, these 10 points are a kind of a research program for people to look into issues of that kind. Yes? Well, the theory of a glancing collision?
Yes.
Yeah. Two things I think were instrumental. One was the moon missions, which showed that the moon is unique in having very few volatiles, which suggested there was some kind of a vaporization event that produced the moon. And then when that, together with the fact that of the high angular momentum and so on, began to be taken into account by Hartmann and Davis, with the development of the theory, but then the critical thing the development of computers so that they could begin computer simulations using advanced models of hydrodynamics, and were able to show that they could account for all of the conditions of the moon as we observe them from a fairly realistic scenario.
Thank you.
Okay, I think I'll...
Yaki?
Maybe Alone in the Universe After All. And it's Real View Books. But if you look on the internet, you can buy it on the internet. I don't know if you can buy it elsewhere, except maybe in a Catholic bookstore. Okay. Sorry to run into your time, Roland, but...